Stop the music. It's time for another SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C., and I am not known for my love poetry. Nope. I can't write a good love poem. I just keep falling back on the cliches. Roses, stars, precious jewels, staplers. I just fall back on the cliches. I am not very good at love poems, and maybe you are not either. Maybe you fall back on the cliches and have trouble writing a love poem that is worth reading. Well, you are in luck because the next SAFTA Workshop, that is the SunTrust Academy for the Arts Workshop, is coming at you on September 27th, 1 to 3 p.m. at Firefly Farms, the home of the SunTrust Academy in Knoxville, Tennessee, with special guest Darren Demery. You can join and learn the secrets about writing a contemporary love poem that avoids those cliches and the crap that is the past. In fact, the title of it sums it all up. Ugh. Writing a love poem that's worth reading. For more information about it, including costs, visit the Sundress store at sundresspublications.com and click store at the top of the page. It's going to be a good one, but maybe, like me, time and space does not allow you to reach this workshop that is happening on September 27th, but you still want to contribute to the Sundress Academy for the Arts in some way. Well, let me ask you a question, actually. Have you ever tried to paint a house in the wintertime? Or even in the fall? I mean, the outside of a house. It's not an easy job. Paint can freeze or get really cold. You know, leaves can fall into the paint and then onto the house. You can't go inside and get warm and watch football and drink hot cocoa. There's snow. There's ice. In a word, it is plain old sucko. It sucks to do it. It just suckos. Well, right now, the SunTrust Academy for the Arts is asking for your help paint the Firefly Homestead. Over the next 7 to 10 days, the SAFTA members will be soliciting donations for supplies and or manpower to accomplish this task. You'll see it on social media. They're patterning this after the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, and they are calling it the SAFTA Paint Bucket Challenge. They may be calling you out on social media to do and donate. And I will tell you right now that the SAFTAcast will be involved in this effort as well. Keep an eye here on the SAFTAcast website or follow us on social media, Twitter, and, well, we don't have an official Facebook page. Maybe we should do that. I don't know. But if you know where I am on Facebook, then you might see it and everything. Keep your eyes peeled because over the next few days, we might just do a little something ourselves to help you out. Called out or no, though, we at the SAFTAcast hope you will donate. To do so, also just like the workshop, go to sundresspublications.com and click on store at the top of the page. We appreciate it in advance. Hey, let's talk about today's show. It's a good one. It's a good one. It's going to fall right into anybody's ADD abilities. Timothy Gager is on the show. Now, we've been trying to get Tim on the show for a while, but due to our schedules and all that, it was tough to work out something, but we finally managed to do it. We finally managed to make it happen, and it was truly a great time and everything. We talked via phone on this one, so a little different than our usual style of chat, and we had a few tech issues, and the first couple of minutes of this interview, this little talk, are a little, you know, wonky in places, but that's okay, because it soon sorts itself out, and we have a lot to talk about in this cast. A lot of topics get covered in a very short time, and it is great. If you want to know more about Tim's work and everything, check out his latest book, The Thursday Appointments of Bill Sloan. Just do a search for that, and you'll find it, or visit his website at timothygager.com. You can also find him on Facebook and on Twitter, at timothygager, and more. So settle in. This is going to be a fun one, as Tim and I get into a whole lot of topics and really kick off maybe those receptors in your brain that call to 70s television nostalgia. But first, I think we need a little bit of theme music. Hello, Tim.
Oh, hi, Scott.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. You know, it's like days of planning this, because I'm like so Skype ignorant. Days of planning this, we finally did it.
Indeed, we did. And I'm going to start it off, really, with the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now. You ready?
Okay.
Given the option, which would you rather go to, the doctor or the dentist?
Interesting. I hardly need either of them. I would probably rather go to the dentist because it's regularly scheduled. If I've got to go to the doctor, there's something wrong. So I don't want anything to be wrong.
Most people I've polled go to the doctor rather than the dentist.
Well, I've only had one cavity my whole life. I've got good teeth. I'm not scared of the dentist. Usually this polishes them up and I'm ready. It's like better than veneers.
I've known people with bad genetic dental problems.
I've seen plenty, and definitely it's people that on the lower economic scales, they get screwed once again, and they get screwed with their dental work and everything else.
That's why I didn't go to the dentist for about 5 years. I didn't have insurance, and we'll put that as a helpful hint to our listeners. Don't neglect your dentistry.
I mean, I'll just sit closer to this house and steal their Wi-Fi.
Yeah, mooch off their Wi-Fi. That works.
Yeah, I'm totally piecing together. I'm using someone else's phone. I'm using their Wi-Fi, someone else's Wi-Fi. And then when they get done with their job, you have to, like, ride around with them, I think.
Well, you have to find a way to pay back your friend. That's all it is, you know.
Strangers walking past watching me talk.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's not like you're on Bluetooth or anything.
No Bluetooth.
No Bluetooth. So you don't look like a complete insane person talking to yourself.
Yeah, that one always throws me for a loop. Whether people in their car, when they're on the phone, they're gesturing, or I don't know if that's singing. Like, that always makes me happy. Like, I'm in a traffic jam, and the person next to me is just, like, singing away. I'm like, cool, you know?
Do you sing in the car a lot?
Sometimes.
What music do you usually jam?
You?
Oh, yeah, of course I do. What music are you usually singing to, though?
You know, my musical taste is almost a little bit of everything, you know? It could be Rancid. It could be... I could be, like, joking along with Celine Dion. Like, it doesn't even matter. If you're in a traffic jam, you're just going to belt it out.
I could see that. Belting out Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On, you know.
The Carpenters. You know, you go from, like, the range from the Sex Pistols to the Carpenters, you're in good shape.
And you can also make up lyrics about the traffic jam you're in, you know.
Yeah, I like to do that. It's always like, you know, you kind of sing a song, you're cruising along, and then suddenly you just throw in, like, a lyric or a rhyme, that like something that rhymes with Enema or something, and you're all set.
I'm now thinking Carpenter's lyrics that would translate well to traffic jams.
Rainy Days and Mondays. That is the most depressing song of all time. You know, Karen is just thinking about all of her problems, and it's raining, and it's a Monday, and she's like, fuck my life.
It is. It is probably one of their most depressing tracks, and I love the Carpenters. I got nothing against them.
I think it's hilarious. I mean, my favorite is the Carpenters documentary movie that all of the characters are played by Barbie and Ken Doll.
I was recently reading an article about that.
Yeah, I think it's called Superstar. It's on YouTube. And there was also a Carpenters TV movie, which was, like, the cheesiest. Like, it was the cheesiest movie of all time because, like, it was so predictable. It was, like, a drunk, like, a pill-bound Richard Carpenter. He's all wasted, and he's like, Karen, come on, have this slice of pizza. It's good for you.
Oh, man.
It was like, man, gee, they're hinting at eating disorders and drug problems all in a pizza box.
It's like a Lifetime original movie before there was Lifetime.
It was, actually. I believe it was a pre-Lifetime movie, exactly. It was like one of those cable channels. You know, it's like back in the 80s on TV when they went into, like, the very special episodes. You know, like, all the characters had, like, you know, drug problems for 30 minutes or eating problems for 30 minutes or, like... And then, like, next week they were fine. Like, Skippy's okay.
And they come out on a stool at the end and say, I'm an actor, but if you do have a gambling problem, contact Gamble Hall.
Exactly, And they, and usually all those actors, like Screech, they all end up all screwed up anyway, which is the most beautiful thing of all.
I can't think of many child stars who actually end up doing all right in the end. There's a couple. Jodie Foster. Mara Wilson turned out pretty good.
Yes. The jury's still out on, who's the Justin Bieber's girlfriend there?
Selena Gomez?
Yeah, jury's still out on her. I mean, Justin Bieber's kind of crashing and burning, which is kind of cool. It's nice to watch that train wreck.
Yeah, I'm just watching it like you would watch a train wreck right now. I'm like, yep, he's just collapsing. I've seen this before.
He's peeing in a mop bucket. Cool. 10 points. 10 child star points for that. But, like, psychologically, though, like, when people try to figure it out, it's like the pressure of being a child star and, like, you know, they missed their childhood. But I don't know. I think there's just something else going on there. There's, like, it almost should have its own diagnosis. The child starism. I'd have to give it a funky name. Latent something.
Latent prepubescent celebrity-titis? I don't know.
Celebrity-titis. It doesn't happen the other way around. I mean, actually, Robert Blake came out okay until, like, he tried to kill somebody. That kind of ruined his, that kind of tarnished his star a bit.
Was Blake a child star, though?
He was. He was in The Little Rascals, like, in the
that's right.
like 1930s, 1940s.
Yeah, not one of them came out squeaky clean.
No, I mean, there was there ever a documentary on, like, Where Are They Now, The Little Rascals?
I'm sure there has been. I think all of them are dead now, save for one. Can't remember.
It might be, you know, Spanky's gone. It might, I don't know. I knew this. This is one of those facts that have you know, that you lose as you get older. I mean, I love talking TV and current TV and old TV because, like, you know, in my novel is very, like, TV-based. And, like, it's a lot of TV references. And, you know, because I just assume that people watched as much television as I did when they were growing up.
Well, you can try me on that because I watched a hell of a lot of television as a kid.
I mean, are you pre-internet? Because, like, when I was a kid, there was no internet.
Oh, yeah. I'm 78, so I watched my 80s shows.
All right, well, all right. In real one, like, TV land, like, who would you rather be with? Like, Jeannie or Samantha from Bewitched?
Oh, Jeannie.
Oh, of course.
Then I'd have a cushy government job.
Exactly. And I think Jeannie's powers were much cooler. And I think they were used more per episode than Samantha. Samantha would do something. Usually it was kind of evil.
But Jeannie didn't have really any interesting in-laws. You had Samantha's mother.
Jeannie had that sister that was Barbara Eden with a dark wig.
That's right, yes.
And everyone was after Madron. I mean, Madron Nelson was kind of a big, like, you know, he kind of was a spaz. But, like, you know, everyone kind of, like, wanted him. Even, like, the Playboy bunnies, when they had those episodes, they were all into the astronaut groupies, so to speak. I think Major Healy got it right, though.
Perhaps he did. You know, that's a good debate, actually. We're probably alienating all our young listeners here.
I know. Well, we haven't even branched into game shows. Well, whenever we talk about the Disney Channel, and we all said, like, at what age do you realize, man, the Disney Channel, this is cool. Like, I'm past, like, Barney. I'm in the cool zone. And then suddenly, like, shit, is it high school that you just dropped the Disney Channel? Like, I'm breaking up with you.
I think it was junior high for me was when I stopped watching, you know, the cartoons in the afternoon of Darkwing Duck and DuckTales and such. It's like, that's about when I was like, okay, maybe it's time to move on.
I mean, for me, it was thank God, because, you know, I have kids, and, you know, the kids did the whole Barneys and, like, Dragon Tales and, like, Blue's Clues. And when they started to watch Disney, when they started to watch, like, Drake and Josh, I was like, okay, I can actually, like, deal with this.
I don't know, some of the really little children's shows I could still watch. I could still watch Sesame Street if I had a child.
Sesame Street wasn't bad, because, like, you know, Elmo kind of saves that.
Yeah, it's not my Sesame Street anymore, but I'm okay with it.
All right, Elmo, attention deficit disorder, right? Snuffleupagus, definitely depressive anxiety issue.
Ernie has manic disorder. He doesn't have bipolar, but he has manic. You've got Cookie Monster has OCD.
Yes.
He has compulsion problems. The Count also has OCD, but a different form.
And Bert, I think, is medicated, so he's flattened out. Like, Bert without medication is on the top of the building. He's ready to jump.
When you actually break it down, all the Muppets have severe psychological issues, except for Kermit.
Wasn't Bob, who sang, like, In My Neighborhood, wasn't he a heroin addict? I believe that he ended up with a drug problem.
No, that was David.
And then they replaced him with another David. They didn't even take the David out of rehab. They're just like, new actor, new David.
Yeah, then they put in Savion Glover into there, who was tap dancer.
Yes.
And then they moved... No, after David came Gina. She took over the store for a while because Hooper died. And so they brought in Gina to kind of take over both roles. And then Savion Glover comes in to kind of take the young role there.
Gina was pretty. I always thought Gina was pretty hot.
She was a very lovely person. I don't remember her that much. I was more interested in the Muppets and the cartoons than I was about the live-action segments.
Well, you know, that just came from my, like, my own warped childhood. I end up sexualizing Sesame Street. But you know what? I got help for that.
That's good. I could admit right now my first weird childhood crush was, of all things, the evil villain on Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
You're not the first.
Who was your childhood celebrity crush?
I'll admit this freely. When I was in, like, my first one was Farrah Fawcett. But, like, the first sort of realistic one that I thought I could actually get that was in a movie was Christy McNichol. And I was, like, I was in, because like, I was in like middle school or junior high, and she looked like she was in junior high, so I was like, that's cool. Like, I had no chance for Farrah Fawcett. I mean, that was like, you know, ultimate fantasy time, but like, you know, that was under the same realm of fantasy as like, hey, I can flap my arms and fly.
Mine was Mayim Bialik of Blossom.
That's a good one.
Go fig. Can't explain it.
Well, you did you feel kind of weird like when, like, that episode that she got her monthly thing? I mean, that was a big episode and how it was handled. And, like, I mean, that just was so damn uncomfortable.
That was one of the few episodes I still remember, if only because of the jokes surrounding the plot. Like Felicia Rashad from The Cosby Show giving her a cake and explaining it. Or she has a dream sequence where Joey loses his hair and everybody spontaneously combusts.
And Joey says, what? What? Yeah. Other celebrity crushes. I mean, I liked, you know, Valerie Bertinelli was okay. And the sister, the drug-induced sister, I kind of liked that. At an early age, I was attracted to that.
I was attracted to the Chiquita Banana lady.
Oh, yeah. Didn't she become someone famous?
I don't know, but she was worried about my health and knew good potassium, so I figured, hey, this is all right. That's how weird I am, though.
It's all right. I mean, people, like, only the people that understand me are kind of the people that are, like, friends in my life. Most of society doesn't understand me. Like, I can't, like, vamp off on things. I think people are amused by it, but, you know, I don't really function in a normal conversational way.
What writer does, though?
Very true, unless they're talking straight writing. I mean, that's sort of a fall. It's like with guys, the fallback is you talk about sports. With writers, the fallback is you can talk about writing. But very often, though, when I'm talking with other writers, they'll just say something that blows me away or, like, they haven't really thought about before, even in, like, whether it is about writing or it isn't about writing.
That's why I find it more interesting to not talk about writing.
Well, it depends. Like, you know, there's always the standard conversations, like ebooks, non-ebooks, Amazon versus the world, how should things be priced, who gets what, why no one seems to be making it, what's going on in the small press, what's going on in the large press. I mean, it's a whole lunch thing.
I understand. That is the standard, and that of who has best grad programs right now, what's the job market like?
What's coming out of those grad programs? I mean, I was sitting with a friend of mine for lunch, and her comment was, how many stories with talking dogs are there going to be?
Many, many more to come, I'm sure.
But there are no talking cats. There's always, like, this talking dog.
Oh, there are many talking cat ones. Come on, we got that one that had Melissa Joan Hart on it, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. We had...
I'm talking about in literature. The talking
oh, in literature?
Cat, TV, yeah, TV, of course, is everything talks.
Oh, yeah, you've got Luna and Sailor Moon. You've got a lot of them. Technically, Bill the Cat from Bloom County.
Yeah, that's
technically,
true.
Technically.
I miss Bloom County. That was a good strip.
That was. I am a huge fan of it. It's my favorite of all time.
And Calvin and Hobbes I liked as well.
That is a solid one. What other ones did you enjoy?
Oh, you know, I stopped. My attention deficit had a difficult time with comics. But, like, you know, and I don't really read comics even now unless it's, like, graphic novels and things like that. But I enjoy. I liked Doonesbury back in his day, back in his heyday when, like, Hunter Thompson was kind of ruling the roost through the Doonesbury strips. And I like some of the serial ones. It was like anything but Nancy.
Ugh. Nancy has gone terribly downhill since Guy Gilchrist got a hold of it the last couple of years. Now he's obsessed with this is what America is, this idealized 1950 thing, and any country star who dies has to be paid homage to.
Speaking of homage, our country, we're so obsessed with, like, celebrity deaths and, like, mourning celebrity deaths. And, I mean, I really kind of don't get it, but...
I've mourned them in my own way. You know, I just take comfort in the fact that their work is still there.
Yeah, I mean, everybody kind of wants to almost feel like they've known these people. And in a way, in their mind, you know, if they've related to a movie or a role, I mean, they are mourning them and they're mourning, like, that connection. But, you know, it does get kind of strange, especially, like, when they have, like, I mean, I don't want to focus on Robin Williams, but, like, you know, when he passed a few weeks ago, there are all these Robin Williams quotes, but most of the quotes should be attributed to the screenwriter, not to Robin Williams. Like, and when the screenwriter dies, no one cares.
Well, it's like, if a movie fails, who do you blame? The director. You never blame the producers who greenlit it.
Exactly. And the producers, God, just so clueless sometimes. Like, I just wish that, I wish the movies in this country were made like the movies in other countries. And, like, we weren't so, I mean, well, everything's connected to the almighty dollar. And the best films, you don't even get to see.
No, and if you do, it's very difficult to obtain them.
Yeah, and even like Netflix, they won't even release them, or like you can't stream them, and it's like you really have to know, be in the know, and like just hunt around, and you know, I mean, I don't mind like going on and streaming something for $3.99 or $4.99. I mean, we're also so used to art for free, but don't get me going on that subject as well. You know.
Well, I mean, I don't mind the occasional big blockbuster. Today, I just sat down and watched The Karate Kid again from 1984 for like the 50th time in my life.
Did you see the new Karate Kid?
I did, and there were moments that were okay and enjoyable, but it just didn't feel... I knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to make a new one for younger audiences, but...
Yeah, and that is, it seems like the audiences are younger and younger, and less people go to the movies, so you have to kind of invent these movies that young people can go to and their parents can go to, because that's a two-for-one ticket right there.
Like Frozen.
Exactly.
With children, you are very well aware of Frozen, I'm assuming?
Well, my kids are older, but they're older now. But, like, yeah, I mean, I'm aware of all that stuff. I mean, the worst was, I mean, we got dragged. I didn't get dragged through. I mean, I actually enjoyed those movies because, like, they all kind of beat the hell out of when my son went through his Pokemon phase, like, 12 years ago. And I swear to God, I had multiple seizures during watching that film. And even on acid, like, I wouldn't connect.
I don't know if I could on acid either.
Like, wow, it's a deep meaning. Like, you know, Pikachu is God. Pikachu is God in the central. And then, what was the kid's name?
Ash.
I was thinking
Ash Ketchum.
Yeah, Ash is the. Yeah, he's like the Jesus figure then, right? And I never understood, I guess, the tribes of the Pokemon, who was with whom and who had fought who and why they would fight and why there'd be battles. Like, I don't know, it seems so random to me. But my son seemed to almost understand this language.
Yeah, I've always wondered, do the Pokemon have languages beyond the one they speak? Like, if you can understand it and you're in Japan, great. But what if you are from Canada? Could you understand them?
And then you're in trouble. I mean, I would love, like... I would love a morphing of, like, you know, Pokemon meets Hello Kitty. See, like, remember, like, in the 60s, everyone would meet each other, like Frankenstein meets Dracula. And, like, you know, there'd be all these cross things, like Laurel and Hardy meet Superman. And, like, there'd be these cross-genre things. So why can't, like, Pokemon meet, like, you know, why can't Pokemon meet, like, Hello Kitty, or Pokemon meet, like, a porn star? That'd be great.
I don't know about the porn star thing. I think, you know, it might be great for certain audiences, but I think it would ultimately alienate both franchises.
Yeah, I think the My Little Pony audience would probably enjoy that one, but
possibly. But you know, I don't know. I've actually never watched the new My Little Pony.
Oh, go on YouTube and like search for bronies, and there's people that are just like adults just going crazy over My Little Pony.
Well, there's a good documentary of it with John DeLancey from Star Trek: The Next Generation, and it was a very enjoyable film. But I've just never sat and watched the show.
Yeah. It's a very, very weird fetish. I mean, I guess all fetishes are weird if they're not your fetish, but it's definitely, for me, it represents a weird one.
Well, to each their own, I think. As long as you're not hurting anybody and, you know, everybody involved is consenting, that's cool with me.
I agree with that.
You know, if you dig it, do it. And if you really dig it, do it twice.
Yep, I'm on that boat for sure.
So, what else is going on? So, are you from the Boston area?
Yeah, I've lived in the Boston area since 1985, so I've lived here more than I've lived any other place.
Were you born in Boston?
I was born on Long Island, New York, in West Islip, and I grew up in a very, very small village called Nisquag, which was attached to St. James, which was attached to Smithtown and Port Jefferson, and it was very rural. My upbringing was very, very rural, and even Nisquag now isn't all that built up. You know, it was a... I don't have a sheltered life, but I definitely did not get a whole lot of street smarts in my upbringing. And like when I went away to college, it was like a whole new world kind of opened up. Like, you know, different people acted in different ways that, you know, they didn't act in my little village.
What made you jump across the harbor there, the channel, to Massachusetts?
I went to college, the University of Delaware. And while I just, beginning of my freshman year, my dad switched jobs and he moved to, moved to the Boston area. And so I started coming back in my college breaks to the Boston area. And when I needed to, in Delaware, I was part of the music scene and in various bands. And I stayed in Delaware 2 years after I graduated college to kind of tour around and play music. And then when things sort of fizzled in my life, I decided to move back to the Massachusetts area, which I was starting, at that point it felt comfortable.
Fair enough. It became almost like a second home to you, and then it became home.
Exactly. I mean, I thought this was where I was going to settle. You know, like, this was a big move. I never really considered, like, okay, I'll hang out in Boston for an area, and then I'll move to California, or then I'll move to, like, other cities I like. I just knew that, this was kind of where I was going to end up.
Just that feel in you.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone, I'm sure it's a very common feeling, like, when you're just kind of like, okay, enough. Like, this is it. This is where I'm going to plant my feet, and whatever happens is going to happen, good or bad. And, like, I've never been a big fan of, like, moving and moving around. I mean, if I think about it, I lived in Long Island, I lived in Delaware, and I lived in Massachusetts, and that's it.
Moving sucks.
It does, especially big moves, because big moves are so representative of things. Like, I know there's so many people, like, them and their, like, their fiancé or their girlfriends or even their spouse, like, they move across the country, and it's a whole, like, it's different. And especially if you're not married or you don't have a family, you're doing this move, because then if the relationship ends, which very often, relationships do end, you're like, okay, here we are in Iowa. I moved here because of you, and there's no longer an us. And that's happened. I mean, I know so many people that do that. But, like, it's for me, it's just the whole digging in. I mean, Massachusetts and the Boston area, I liked it. I liked the weather. I liked the seasons. And I liked that the summers weren't all that hot. Like, when I first got, 25 years ago, the summers in Boston were very similar to this summer. Not too hot and cool at night. And this has been a great summer in Boston, for weather-wise. And, maybe in the past 10 years, it's gotten hot and humid again, but I have no complaints about Boston this summer. It's just been beautiful.
I've been to Boston a few times, and it's a great city. I don't like the driving around there. It's one of the worst cities to drive, but
the cities themselves are now okay, but like Boston's sort of kind of becoming like California. Like, there's a traffic jam on 95 and 90 nearly every time you're on it, and any time is the potential. And that's changed a lot. I mean, that's been one of the biggest changes, the traffic and the traffic patterns.
But no, I've enjoyed my time in Boston. It's a beautiful city. I was there for AWP a couple of years ago.
I was at that one, obviously.
It was a lot of fun. It was a middle of, snowstorm in the middle of it, and I enjoyed that.
Well, I remember that. Yeah, I remember driving into the snowstorm, and that was a good AWP. Like, Boston, probably because it was like home to me. It was kind of like, I'm going to commute in, and I had a press pass for it from one of the local newspapers in the Somerville Times, and I wrote to AWP, and they let me cover.
And you didn't have to worry about a hotel or anything?
No, it was great. Just parking. I mean, I jumped around various parking meters or parking garages. I mean, obviously most people would take the mass transit, the T, but I, I'm not a big fan of the trains and the buses, a couple people, we just kind of drove in.
I recall having a lot of fun there. It was a fun one. And a couple good, nice old pubs nearby I enjoyed.
Oh, did you go to any of the offsite readings?
I went to a couple. Problem with AWP is you can only go to a couple of them every night at most. And it often boils down to, okay, which of my friends is there?
Yes. And AWP has become like a friend connect versus, and it's huge now. And like, if you're gonna go to Seattle or Minneapolis, it's expensive.
Yeah, at least $1,000.
At least, and am I getting $1,000 worth of? Like, if you're a small press or a magazine or an author, you're definitely not gonna get $1,000 worth of sales or connections. So it's basically, you gotta view it as a vacation. You sit through some really good panels, run into people that you run into very occasionally, or you meet people that you've kind of known online for years or have been published with, and that's always nice.
Yeah, to me, it's a combination of an academic conference, a homecoming, and a drunken bacchanal.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I try to avoid some of the drunken. I mean, I've kind of been there, done that in my life. So, which is, you know, the AWP was just as enjoyable for me without that. And that's another, I guess, another thing that I kind of want to, like, this is one of my big pet peeves in life and about riding and about events. I mean, I haven't had a drink in 4 years, but like events, it's not that I'm like, I mean, I'm aware of like how fun it is to drink and to get drunk, but like, it seems like nearly every new event they're promoting, like instead of promoting the authors and the writing and the community, even they promote the drink, like come here, Steve Almond, and get drunk.
You have to do that a little bit now to get younger attendees in there.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, you know, come on in, we're having drink specials tonight.
But do younger attendees need that prompting? You know what I mean? Like,
do you really need to tell a 23-year-old, come to this bar and listen to this poet and get drunk?
Or a 23-year-old, like, hey, there's a reading at a coffee shop, you're going to have to bring a flask. Like, they get it, you know?
There are unwritten rules.
We're gonna pump up the cool factor. But, like, you know, for me, it's like... I've run a literary series. For me, it's sort of like catching people that don't read in Boston, catching not the normal person, and having them read and having it at your event. I mean, for me, that's exciting.
I think it's fun when you get the people who normally might not check out your reading or something, and you manage to snag them, and they're like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And then they become not maybe lifelong readers, but they become long-term readers.
Yeah, and that's really, really important, too. Like, I think it's very, very often, especially in the younger writers, and younger writers do well. And, like, you know, my first book, which was kind of garbage, did well because it's like, this is my friend, this is my writing friend, and the first book generally does good, generally does well. But, like, you know, when you're into, like, 3 or 4 books deep, like, you know, you've already sold the books to friends and family and whatnot, and now it's like, okay, where is my market? Like, who do I read?
Where do I go next?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, and right now I'm at 11 books. People aren't buying my books to be nice anymore. I mean, yes, some do. Maybe a lot do. But it's like, you know, it's very strange. Like, there's probably no one on earth that has 11 of my books, period.
Except you.
Yeah. Oh, I've got a couple thousand. They're in my closet. They're in the trunk of my car, and they're under the bathroom sink. So wherever I can find the storage.
So you get a little bit of that experience then of the shilling from maybe those band days in Delaware. You know what it's like to be at a merch table.
Exactly. And I know what it's like to set up gigs and to travel and what it's really going to be like and what the ups and downs are. Like, when you play locally and you're a touring band and you're popular, you get hundreds of people. Then suddenly, like, you book a gig, like, in Chicago or in Florida where you're at, and you have to be happy in front of 3 to 15 people. You have to be. Otherwise, you should hang it up. So I kind of know that, like, yeah, I'm going out to California. I'm going out to the West Coast in a month. And I know that, like, if I draw, like, if I get 15 people to a reading, you know what? That's going to be great.
You got to give those 15 people the best damn show you can because they paid to be there, or maybe they didn't pay, but they're there giving you their time.
Exactly. And, like, you know what? And there's no time to feel sorry. I've done readings in front of one person. You know, I've gone out of town and they've not promoted or whatever, or I've not promoted, or it's kind of like... You know, I've jumped on a plane and I've spent $300 and I figured, you know what, I'm going to get in front of people and, like, you know, aren't I wonderful? And on the flip side, if one person shows up, you can't be like, don't I suck? I mean, you're neither wonderful nor do you suck. It's just kind of like, you kind of have to take it kind of as a separate thing.
I know the feeling totally well. I've performed shows for 20 people in a room, maybe less, and I'll still give them the best damn show I can.
Exactly. And who knows what the outside influences are. Like, if it's like you're doing a Boston reading or a Boston musical performance and it's, you know, Super Bowl Sunday and the Patriots are in it, guess what? It's not you. It's something else.
And not only that, you never know. You may hit that 1 out of 10 people at the show just the right way with your show.
And that's it. And you don't even know who that one person might be. You know, maybe that one person writes for Rolling Stone magazine and you're doing an acoustic set without your band because your band all quit on you. And they're like, okay, this person is wonderful. You know, you never know. Could never be know what your connections are.
Could be the bouncer knows somebody who knows somebody and is like, dude, you should come by the bar next week and check out this person when they read. It's cool.
Or not even career-wise. I mean, like, you know, the bouncer's like, hey, my sister's single, and, like, let's go get a drink. She's right next door. And then, like, you know what? And you fall in love and you marry. You know, you never know. Like, it's funny.
Dare I ask, is that how it happened for you?
Well, I'm sure. You know what? If I think about, like, how I've met important people in my life, and if various variables were different, including, like, if I had an extra cup of coffee at home or I didn't catch a traffic light, my life would have been totally different.
Yeah, it's the small things that change everything.
Yeah, and you have to view it that way, too, like, in terms of career and in other types of things and in friendships and in relationships. You have to view it as, like, that, you know, like, if you had a fender bender or, like, you're at that intersection that a car ran a red light and struck you, you know what? Like, if you had done one thing differently or missed it or, like, earlier in your commute missed a traffic light, you wouldn't have been at that intersection. You have to kind of look at life that way. Everything is there for a reason, and if you try to control everything, you try to control your life, you know, you just can't.
Life is a series of cause and effects punctuated by subjectivity.
Exactly. And I guess if you thought about it, if you think about that all the time, you just would go mad.
Not necessarily. I think you go more mad when you start to realize that death is 1 foot away from you at all times.
That is true. Oh, and I was telling someone, between music and writing and family and people in my life, like, you know, if I were to have a massive heart attack while on the phone with you, I could basically just say that I've had a good life. You know, I'm happy with my life. You know, it's not perfect, but, like, you know, things worked out for me, and I've got to experience some great things. And, you know, and I think not a lot of people can think that or can say that, and, you know, I've been lucky.
Most of us are, you know, even those of us who suffer under horrible psychological diseases, such as depression, there are moments where you almost feel like the whole thing is worth it in life.
I agree with that. And, you know, the people that suffer with that, I mean, my heart goes out to them when they're having their struggle.
It does. I've seen it in people I've known, and it's horrible to watch.
And I've had moments that I've been depressed, and you never think you can climb out of that hole until you're out of that hole. And it's not even, you're not even trying to climb out of that hole, just something happens, or you wake up, or if it's a new day, or whatever it is, that's when you come out of it.
And you don't even know when it's going to start either. It could be a major event like the death of a family member, or it could just be a whole bunch of pressures all at once create the perfect storm in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, usually for me, it's usually a bunch, like big things I deal with. If there's a bunch of little things and none of them seem consequential, but they're all kind of there and happening at once, that's sort of when I go into my dark places. Because I guess it's like, maybe I start to question, like, am I really getting bummed out about having to buy two new tires, and I did something wrong, and I disappointed somebody, but it's not a big deal because they forgave me. And, like you know, that's the kind of buildup of, like, maybe 10 to 15 of those things that always catches me. Because I always end up questioning, like, why am I like this?
Right. No, I think that, again, I've said in the past that find me a writer who is psychologically stable, and I will show you the most boring shit you will ever read.
You know what's funny? Like, there's always, like, you know, the stereotype, the drunken writer or the crazy writer or, like, you know, name it. But if you go out there and if you really look at the field, like, you look at other industries and, like, you look at, like, stockbrokers, there are as many drunk, crazy stockbrokers as there are drunk, crazy writers. But we don't view that as that stereotype.
No, we love the idea of the tortured artist.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I mean, I think, yeah, it's okay to have some trauma in your life that you can draw from to make it real. But, like, I think there are plenty of tortured chefs and tortured busboys and tortured dry cleaning people and tortured millionaires.
So you don't need to have a bad childhood to be a good writer.
Definitely not. I think to be a good writer, you have to have had some experiences. And to be a great writer, you have to maybe not have those experiences and be able to portray them and make people feel. I mean, you can always come, like, I think in my own stuff, like, when I'm trying to project out of my own personal experiences, whether intentionally or not, it kind of rings flat. But not, like, major flat. It's just, like, you know, it's the difference between, like, a good song and a great song. Like, you know, like, you hear, like, a song on the radio or on a CD or on your MP3. Like, that's a good song. And then there are certain songs that, like, you automate, the song ends and you hit the back button so you can hear it again.
I'll give you one right now that, you know, The Who's Baba O'Reilly.
Yeah, it's genius. Well, Townsend was such a genius with in that whole period when he was doing the whole like epic songs and epic albums and like, and you know, the Who never really got credit for being like an art band and art rock, but you know, the whole rock opera thing they did, the Quadrophenia and Tommy and whatnot, like, you know what, they were an art band and they did it well, and amazingly they kind of did it within their constructs.
I think Eddie Vedder put it really well when he was paying tribute to the Who. He said, "I really hate you guys because after you, there were no more doors to break down."
That's true. But, like, you know, you got to be really, really careful because within that creativity and that success, like, obviously, I think, like, you know, Townsend and Daltrey were able to step back from it. And, like, Keith Moon just kind of, he just fiddled and, like, he just crashed and burned. Like, you know, it's funny at first, but, like, you know, when you're in the seriously under the, you know, the grips of drug and alcohol addiction, you know, suddenly, like, throwing, like, television sets out the window is not funny anymore.
Yeah, it's like the first couple times, like, whoa, he's so crazy. But I think in retrospect, then you go, wait a minute, what's really going on here with him?
He's not functioning, and, like, he is affecting other people's lives, and, you know, eventually, you know, he's dead.
Is it compulsion to keep throwing them, to keep making a scene, or is there something darker going on? Is it maybe self-destruction, self-hatred? It could be
I think there's a lot of that. I think it's all of the above, and it's also the expectation, too. Like, if you do things a certain way, like, all right, if you're someone a little less tortured in the same band, like, the expectation is that Townsend's going to break his guitar. Is that staged? Yeah. Is some of, was some of Keith Moon's stuff, even though it was wild and crazy, was some of it staged? Probably. In his mind, like, wow, I can get a rise out of people if I, you know, do this or do that.
Like putting dynamite in his drum kit on the Smothers Brothers show and giving Townsend tinnitus.
Yeah, that's a great clip, actually. I mean, I'm not laughing that Townsend guy ended up with the tinnitus, but when it happened, the rest of the band members, I was jumping, they all had this what the fuck look on their face.
Yeah, I live for those moments in watching performances and such. That's why I love local news and live television. Just, I'm always waiting for the boom mic to drop into the shot.
Or the one where Keith passes out tranquilizer and they say, does anyone in the crowd know how to play the drums? And they pulled someone from the audience and he was pretty good.
Well, they ended up getting a decent replacement drummer in the 90s and currently still kind of on tour with them. And
Kenny Jones, right?
Kenny Jones, but also Ringo Starr's son.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a great... Ringo Starr is very underrated as a drummer, and his son is really, really good as well.
I would agree. Ringo doesn't get enough credit.
No, he doesn't. And probably, you know what, like, I mean, McCartney definitely took the legs out from under him, because Ringo was a very good technical drummer. He was strong. But then, like, McCartney, it was when they stopped getting along or they couldn't get together. McCartney started to play all the drum parts. It was kind of like, I think, the layman or the person that just listened to their record would be like, oh, you know, McCartney's just as good or Ringo's terrible. He got replaced. And that probably wasn't the case at all.
No, I know that during the White Album, Ringo quit the band for one day because he couldn't take it anymore. And he came back and John had decked out the entire drum kit in flowers as a way of saying, we're sorry.
You know, yeah, I mean, music was so important to me growing up. It was, you know, it's always there, you know. And it's funny, like, you know, in today there's always something there. There's the internet. There are people on the internet. There's, you know, your phones. And, you know, and they're great. You know, I think it's wonderful to have... people are always like, oh, society sucks. No, I think it's wonderful that all that stuff exists. But when it didn't exist, like, you know, the stereo and music. For me, that was music. When there was when I felt there was nothing else in my life I could turn on, like put on an album or turn on the radio and be like, okay, there is something that I relate to.
Before videotape, albums, vinyl, were the cheapest form of entertainment where no matter how many times you listened to it, it was always the same.
Yes.
You could just rewind and play it again and it would sound just as good.
Yeah, and I mean, I still have vinyl that I've bought. It's pared down. At one point I had like thousands and thousands of albums and I think I'm down to like a couple hundred. But like...
I'm down to one milk crate worth, but yeah. I've kept the ones that are really important to keep.
And usually it's a night I'll have like sentimental album night, like, and that's when, and I play albums in a row and that's it. Like, or, I mean, I don't, like, normally reach for my albums.
Right, they become special ones.
Yeah.
Unless you make MP3s and digital copy of them and everything and make them that way, but...
Yeah, I mean, I've saved a lot of, like, Boston area bands' albums and, like, you know, my punk albums and stuff. They really... Well, now, of course, you can find nearly everything on YouTube, including commercials.
And the rare stuff, too. You can find the rare stuff out there.
Yeah, and, like, I think it's great. I mean, how I feel about that in terms of, like, I know that, like, I mean, every time you listen to YouTube for free, it's like, is it something that I would have bought? You know, that's a problem. You know, I think people are like, you know, the music industry died when, like, once Napster hit, which is, to a certain extent, it's true. And, like, you know, the 90s, kind of underground bands were all getting signed for big money at one point, and now it's there aren't really a whole lot of new bands that are out there and are making money. The way you make money is on tour, and those aren't the new bands, those are the older bands. So what's going to happen when the older bands get really, really old, like, and people aren't used to seeing the new bands in concert? That's kind of the next flattening out.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen with our children, but all at the same time, I can't totally dump on Napster and the rise of them, because on the flip side, they helped a lot of people get introduced to bands that they never knew existed or that they'd only heard of.
And so does it lead to sales? I mean,
that's the question.
I mean, Apple, I think the music industry would have totally have died until, like, you know, iTunes. iTunes actually invented a way that music could be bought again, which is genius if you think about it. They kind of cornered the market and did it, and because they cornered the market, you know, they were able to do that and kind of keep music alive for X amount of more years. And then to a certain extent, Amazon tried to do that with the Kindle. Like, this is the only form that we can get your electronic books, and we can price the electronic books for a certain amount to kind of keep that going and keep the publishing industry from, you know, when they're doing their little fade and their little downward spiral. But now Kindle's kind of not that unique anymore. There's various readers and various ways to read online. Well, I'm not.
And it's gotten better, too, the technology. I remember in the early days of ebooks, poetry volumes just looked horrible on them.
Yeah, because who cares? Line breaks, be damned. Whether the poet intended it or not. Yeah, I had one of the early e-readers in the 90s. I'm trying to remember its name, but it was kind of cool. But the big publishers and even the middle publishers didn't buy into it. So there was a lot of really underground writing that you get in e-books, and there's a lot of very small, like, e-book publishers that didn't even do print on demand. They just did e-books. That was it. So, I mean, the very first thing that I got published was ebook form only. And you still can't get it in print, ever.
Unless I specifically request it from you, that kind of thing.
No, it's not available in print. It was from an ebook exclusive publisher only. Hmm. And it's a 90-page short story volume, and it's only in an e-reader form. It's never been in a paper form. And the same publisher did my second book, and it was the same way. And finally I said, look, I want something in print, and they started branching into print on demand right before I made that request, so it was no problem for them to convert that there.
I don't know what to think really about print on demand. On one hand, it's great in some ways. I've seen it work really well for small presses, but the flip side of it is that it allows a lot of bad writing to exist.
True. Well, it depends on if there's a publisher and there's an editing process. I think that that's the stereotype of self-publishing. Like, you know, you're going to find the diamond in the rough because, you know, traditionally it's harder to find good writing for self-publishing. Not that it doesn't exist, because it certainly does. But, like, for print-on-demand, you definitely need to look for the publishers that have an editing process, a formatting process.
Who have some credibility, basically.
Exactly. I mean... Yeah. One thing I do find, which is, maybe I'm the only one that figured this out because I don't really hear too many people talking about it, but there's a certain breed of print-on-demand publishers, and I'll put that in brackets, and all they want is to make the quick $400 or $500. They'll put out anthologies or people's books, and they don't edit them at all, but they know And they don't offer the author copies, free copies, which is kind of a sin. You should get at least one. So what they do is they throw together a volume. They know that there are 15 or 20 authors. The cost of the publisher to print on print on demand is like, you know, $4 or $5, but they're selling them to their own authors for $15. So they're making that quick $300. And they're not doing much except formatting. And they're sending all the stuff to a print on demand company, and that's that. And I found out really quickly when, like, I realized I've been in some of these and I have to buy my own copy and the product's not getting out there and my stuff online is more read than that stuff. I realized, okay, I mean, maybe not their intention is to make that quick buck, but that's sort of what's happening.
That makes you get that sense of it, even if it's not true, you get that impression of it.
Like, I'm buying my own work, but no one else is really buying it except the other authors in the volume. So the publisher is the one that makes the pay differential. I never get generally it's tough because I generally won't get a royalty out of that, period. And so what's in it for me?
Yeah, I love my students who think that writers get paid and have money.
And not even students. Look at various movies. There are so many. Actually, recently I'm more and more aware of the writer character in movies. And they always show up at these readings in these auditoriums for hundreds of people. And it's like, it's really not like that. It's like that for the Richard Russos of the world, you know, and the Stephen Kings of the world. But like, you know, there's the character, you know, maybe played by Timothy Hutton or some sort of actor. And it's like, he's releasing his first book. And he's like, it's almost as if he's out at Shea Stadium. You know, he's doing his first reading. It's like at Shea Stadium.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. There's only an elite group that can be A-listers.
And, like, I think it's like, you know, people are like, you know, Tim, you're a writer. They're like, wow. It's like, well, it's not really that wow. And even, like, you know, some of the people I know, they might be on HarperCollins, and they have 4 or 5 books, and they struggle. They're not, I mean, they're making a living, but barely.
Yeah, we take second jobs. We're teachers. We're, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Or we take first jobs, and writing is sort of the hobby. I mean, I guess movies and screenplays, if they get made, you're in decent shape. Or if you get an option for your book, you know, that's okay.
I've heard that a lot of MFAs right now for fiction writers, they're saying best place to get into is serial television.
Oh, yeah, because that's the wave, you know, Breaking Bad and the Orange is the New Blacks. I mean, that's the buzz. That's what people are talking about, and that's what people are watching.
As someone who enjoys good stories and such, I prefer that over reality television.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I reality television is really, really weird, and that too is staged. It's not reality. I had a chance to be, well, since they never paid me, they warned me if I talked about it, I wouldn't get paid, but I didn't get fucking paid anyway. I was an extra in a reality TV show, and I signed this contract because it was filmed in this setting where I was having, like, you know, dinner and some drinks. And the whole thing was fake. Like, okay, the characters are going to walk in, and we want you guys to cheer. And, like, we're watching this boxing match now on TV, so I want you guys to, you know, you extras to throw punches in the air and cheer. And, like, because they're supposed to be betting on this. And while the boxing match, the quote boxing match is going on TV, it was Animal Planet was going on the TV. So I was, like, yelling things like, the boxer's a dog! He's a real dog! And
Spider-Wolf, like, Spider-Wolf, kill him!
Yeah, and it was like, and the show had to do with this scary, real mobster in Boston. And at one point, I like stepped on his foot, and he was like, he's gonna fucking kill me. I'm like, oh man, like, what's in this for me? It's not what the contract I signed for $17.36. Let's forget about this. No, it never made it on TV. The episode I was in never made it.
I loved showing my students, like, the contract for the real world from MTV that the Greenwich, the Village Voice put out a few years ago. They got a hold of it. And I showed them excerpts of it, and they're like, well, why would anybody ever do this? You know, you basically, if you are a songwriter and you sing, say, the 4 or 5 seconds of a song you're writing on TV, Viacom Industries owns the whole song.
Exactly. Facebook does the same thing. People don't realize if you stick a poem on Facebook, Facebook owns it. Not that Facebook has done anything shifty ever with something like that, but if Facebook wanted to put out an anthology of poems and they like your poem, they don't even have to ask you. They could put it out. So, like, if you have got a name for yourself and you're posting stuff online, they can make the money on it if they wish to. They own it. not that they come after you. Like, obviously you can publish it elsewhere, but like, just it's something to be very, really, really careful about. Everything you put on that site, they have rights to.
Well, a lot of, I've talked to a number of publishers in the writing circles and such, and they say, you know, technically posting, you know, a work in progress on Facebook counts as a publication credit.
As your own work on your blog does as well. But I don't necessarily buy that. I mean, it doesn't feel that way. I never post, like, stuff there. But there are other people that say, and these are fairly, like, middle-range writers, they're like, you know what, if I put a poem up on Facebook that I think is finished, I'll get like 2,000 people reading it. If I get published in an online literary magazine or in a print magazine, I might get a lot of people that say they read it, but they really aren't reading it. So, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's whatever you're comfortable with.
I guess it also depends on what you want as a writer. What are your goals?
And that's very true. Do you want to be patted on the back by a bunch of people? Do you want to put out a book that your friends and family can see? Do you want to make a living out of it? Do you want to be a real craft? Do you want to work your craft? And, like, you know what? In a certain extent, I want all four. Like, I want to have great craft. I want people patting me on my back. I want friends and family to like it. And I want to make a living from it. I mean, I don't, what's wrong with all four?
Nothing's wrong with it, but I think as a writer, you have to be aware of the goals. You have to be realistic and temper them and say, okay, am I ever going to be part of the elite group of A-listers? Maybe not.
Yeah.
What would make me happy, though, as a writer, when I look back on my life?
Yeah. I mean, I agree that people need to be realistic, and, like, I know there's a lot of people that are coming out of MFA programs, they're like, we're saving our submissions for the New Yorker. Well, you might be good enough to get into the New Yorker. Tons of people are good enough to get into the New Yorker. But in terms of, all right, short story, New Yorker puts out 25 issues a year. They generally don't have open submissions. They get publicists that say, hey, here's a new story about this person who's got a new book out. They ask for other people. Generally, the New Yorker is only really publishing maybe two stories out of their open submissions a year. So if you're coming out of your MFA program, like thousands and thousands of others, you know what? It's a numbers game, and your numbers are not good.
But if you just want to publish a book that your friends and family can enjoy, or maybe get a couple strangers to buy off of your website or something, if that's your level of happiness, then by all means, go for it.
And nothing wrong with that. But there's, I mean, obviously, you hang out on the same Facebook pages that I hang out on, Scott, and it's kind of like there are so many people, and, you know, it's always like you have to promote. So there's a bunch of writers that are making a lot of noise, and I am one of them, I have to admit. So it's sort of like if you want a book with your friends and family, you're making the same amount of noise as somebody that's got a major publication. So it gets very noisy in there.
It does, and it's also, it's hard, I think, sometimes because so many of those people are good writers, too.
Agreed.
And you want all of them to succeed.
And you want all of them to be read, and you want to read, and there are so many books that I want to read, but there are more books on my bookshelf unread at this point than I have time to read. And that's a shame, because I'm busy doing other things, and writing is one of them, and living my life is the other.
My Netflix queue and my library are about the same right now. It's like there's so many things sitting there. One day I'm going to get to this film. One day I'm going to sit down with this TV show.
Well, I used to have the books, the next on the book queue on my nightstand, but then it just got to be too depressing, the number of books on my nightstand. That, like, another year went by, and for Christmas I get more books, and I hadn't read the Christmas books from 2012, so I don't have books on my nightstand anymore. I have food on there.
About the only books that really get read in my house anymore are the ones I keep next to the toilet.
Yeah, and they better be short pieces.
Yeah, like The Onion or something. You know, their volumes are big. Oh, okay, well, this takes a couple minutes here. Oh, I forgot about that article. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I'm reading Rusty Barnes' book, Reckoning, and that's a great book. Like, that's just a super, super book. And, like, you know, he's one of those guys, he's a lot of us. He's like an underdog and you root for him. He's got some chops, man.
Yeah. Speaking of the promotion and everything, you watch at AWP and you stroll through the book fair and everyone has a reading and you would love to go to as many of them as you could. You really would. There's so many good writers out there, and I think that's a damn shame that, you know, you want all of them to succeed.
Exactly. And it's kind of like, and everyone's in their booths, like, check this out, look at our press, look at our magazine. And I remember going to, it was very similar, I went to the Baltimore Book Festival, and they had these, like, these little booths outside, and this was, you have people walk through, and then people like grabbing you, have a bookmark, have this, like, you know, here's a candy with the book's name on it, or whatever. And they also had like a bandstand with music on it, so I was like, you know, I was selling like one book in 6 hours in this cattle call, you know. So I was like, I'm gonna put all my books in the backpack. I had all this stuff printed that I was giving people. People were more than happy to take a sheet of paper with your bio on it and not buy the book. So I walked down to the bandstand with my backpack full of books, and I just started talking to people like, this is me, this is a book festival, and here's my book. And I put the book in their hand, and I sold like 100 books. And I came back, and the person I shared the book with was like, how'd you do today? I said, well, I sold 100. They're like, I sold 2. And they're like, how do you do it? They're like, I'm going to buy you dinner. I need to figure out how you did this. So we went to dinner in the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, and there's all these Navy guys there, and I sold like 25 more books.
It almost sounds like classic music hustling there, basically.
Yeah. Well, it was a lesson, too, for me, and like for AWP and all those other conferences. People are buying the person. They're not necessarily buying the book or the subject matter. If you come across and you're a nice person and a nice guy and you're enthusiastic and whatever, and if people, like, good God, if people manage to like you, you're going to sell a book.
And, you know, you're right about the name thing, because you go to a booth and you may not know the press, but you see a copy of a book by an author's name you've heard of. And maybe you've read a piece of theirs in some journal, and you're like, I didn't know they had a book. I must get this. So what you got in the works coming up that you want to promote?
My first novel was released. It's called The Thursday Appointments of Bill Sloan, and it's doing really, really well, and people are enjoying it, and it's kind of a nice feeling as a writer. And it's also, I am leaving my safe Massachusetts home, and I'm going to read in San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon, and New York City in the month of October and early November. So that I'm promoting, and it's kind of going to be exciting to travel.
Excellent. And how can the folks find you at home on, you know, on the internet? Where are you found?
Oh, I live at Timothy Gager, G-A-G-E-R, timothygager.com. Or you can search Timothy Gager, or search The Thursday Appointments of Bill Sloan, or search for Timothy Gager writer. As long as you spell G-A-G-E-R, there are not too many G-A-G-E-Rs out there.
Are you on the Twitter at all?
I am, and I'm at Timothy Gager. And I'm on the Twitter, I'm on the Facebook, and I have my own webpage, and I've got a blog, timothygager.blogspot.com.
So. Awesome. So folks at home can find you and check you out and everything, and definitely check out one or more of those 11 volumes. I'm impressed.
Well, Scott, it's really fun talking to you. I'm glad that we went over TV and music and like pop culture, and we even got around to writing. So.
I'm sure we could probably fill another 3 hours with the stuff we didn't talk about.
We haven't even talked about pets yet.
No, we didn't even talk about pets, or I have no idea what else. I know you're also a sports fan. We didn't get into that.
And food. I'm a big fan of food. I could talk about food for hours. And sports, and watching sports and eating.
Well, who knows? Maybe we'll have to meet up. Maybe if you're going to AWP, maybe we'll meet up in Minneapolis.
That would be awesome. And it was so nice to talk to you.
It was nice to connect with you finally. I know it was a bit of a hassle, but we managed to make it work. So you take care of yourself tonight, all right?
All right, you too. Thanks very much.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.